todo el mundo.
But this was really
1981.
Welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. I'm your host, Stacey Lane Wilson, author of the Rock and Roll Nightmares book series and director of the documentary The Ventures, Stars on Guitars. This is your destination for all things rock, where the interviewees include musicians, authors, historians, filmmakers, and more. And now, on to the show. Today's guest is a true music industry legend, Dave Robinson. As the co-founder of Stiff Records, Dave was at the forefront of the punk and new wave movements, working with iconic artists like Elvis Costello, Ian Dury, and The Damned. Dave's career spans decades, including time as a tour manager for Jimi Hendrix and even photographing the Beatles and the Rolling Stones in their heyday. Now he's managing the up-and-coming British band Hardwick Circus. Join me as we dive into his incredible career and his vision for the future of music. Hi, Dave. Welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast.
Well, I've always wanted a rock and roll nightmare. I've had several of them in the past, but never with somebody so good-looking as you there, Stacey.
Well, I want to dive into the past a little bit before we touch on the future. Stiff Records, of course, was groundbreaking in so many ways. I'm wondering what inspired you to co-found the label and what, you know, I mean, I'm sure you had aspirations, but did you really know that it would be such a pivotal part of music history?
No, for the latter question there, no, I had no idea at all. In terms of starting it, I had had the kind of feeling for a long time that there was an independent label required to fill a big void in what was the music business as we have it. I tour managed Jimi Hendrix, which is a very big part of my early career, obviously, and I get a lot of questions about that. They always seem to think that we spend most of our time bashing up the ceiling on various events. However, it occurred to me, I was a young guy from Ireland. I didn't have any real experience of touring. And in America, particularly, I think more or less five bands had toured where you had the Beatles, the Animals, Herman's Hermit, them, and one other. And I can't quite remember who. So, I have a support band on the Jimi Hendrix tour, and the tour manager got ill and had to go back to England to get expensive medical treatment, gallbladder or something. So I was given the briefcase and the Beretta, told I could wear it concealed, etc., which was entirely big news to me. I had no idea, but if you're carrying money in those days, the insurance didn't work. Unless you carried a gun. I'm there looking after Jimi Hendrix and everybody else. And it occurred to me really that he wasn't really very well looked after by his management. I couldn't get all the information that I required to be a tour manager because I was having to make up some elements of it myself. But I got the feeling, I mean, Jimmy didn't seem to have any spare time of his own. He wasn't really, people just added to my chores in terms of get him to do this, get him to do that. And there's a 3 o'clock, and then there's a 3:30. And it went on and on and on. Yet here was one of the greatest guitar players the world had ever known, trying to do his best without any great information, also. There was like, what's happening, Dave? Where am I? What is going on? What am I doing tomorrow? So I realized at that point that one day I would become a manager and I would do it differently. And Stiff, really, at the end of the day, was pretty much my version of that, where the record company would be a partner with the artist and we would work together to make something happen. So Stiff, early days, it was like a hobby, putting out a few records, Nick Lowe, the Pink Fairies, Richard Hell. And then gradually the public really tuned into it. So they kind of forced my hand. I stopped eventually managing Graham Parker and The Rumour and several other bands that I had a hand in. Ian Dury as one, Elvis Costello, Declan McManus. As he's returning to, I believe, nowadays. And so that was the early days of Stiff with no real idea that it would take off.
Well, it was one of the coolest labels with your innovative campaigns and your funny slogans. Do you have a favorite memory from that era, like going around like the marketing aspect of it?
Well, marketing, I thought, was something that a record company should be doing. The major record companies of the time seemed to think that the band killing themselves on the road was the marketing plan. Their slogan, their famous slogan, which they're still using to my amazement, which didn't do anything for the public, it's out now. I didn't think that that was really sufficient. If you wanted to encourage people to listen to music that they hadn't heard or a band they hadn't seen, you had to stimulate them a bit. And humor is the one that we all remember. We remember the funny joke, remember the people standing on the banana skin. Charlie Chaplin was a great originator of Stiff. And so humor was the essence of it, which we came up with proverbs, slogans. Everybody then started to get into the game, so I was sent an awful lot of them. I mean, money talks, people mumble, that's a good one. We lead, others follow, but can't keep up is, but there are lots and lots, and I collect them now.
Well, yeah, people are still talking about some of those slogans. You mentioned that, of course, some of the iconic artists that you've worked with, like Elvis Costello, The Damned, of course, is probably one of the first bands that really helped your label and vice versa. Is there a particular artist or moment in time that really stands out for you as one of your proudest accomplishments?
Well, I often think of Jonah Louie, a very odd individual who had a couple of very big hits on Stiff. And he was the man least likely to in a lot of ways. Very nice gentleman, very, very nice bloke, always very helpful, wanting to get on and wanting to do things, and writing an awful lot of songs. But you'll always find me in the kitchen at parties. Has a special resonance for me because Jonah is one of the most talkative people in the entire world. And my wife would, if I w were I to say before the evening came on that Jonah had a meeting with me, he liked evening meetings, she knew that we wouldn't get out of it for hours. So she had a thing about Jonah. It was a kind of an amusing side to our relationship and to mine with Jonah.
Well, you did assemble the Bob Marley Legend album. So, aside from being the best-selling reggae album of all time, how do you look at its legacy today after all these years?
Well, somebody, some person wrote a headline which I really revered. I thought it was one of the great ones, where they said Dave Robinson, who made a legend out of Bob Marley, and I liked that. He wasn't the reason for him. I was a big fan, but he actually really wasn't selling the quantity of products, albums, etc., that I had envisualized before I went to Island Records, and Chris Blackwell said, "Why don't you do the best of Bob Marley, a project?" Bob was really a cult figure. His name was much bigger than the amount of records he was selling. I often thought that Island seemed to keep him in camouflage gear. He always looked like he was in some kind of military outfit. And I think in my mind, I thought the public, particularly the female end, certainly of the UK public, didn't quite understand him, and the dreadlocks, and the fact that he never seemed, the pictures that Ireland put out of him never seemed to have him smiling. He never seemed to be amused by anything. It was always hard work. And I thought that we should market him the way he actually was a very great songwriter, with a great spirit and great lyrics and great political acumen, though not very well educated. And we should market him like that. So Legend was my concept of that particular angle that I came up with. I am a marketing person. I'm a record person. Of music, obviously, big in my life. But I do like to try and find the angle that I think the public might get onto. So the slogans and all the stiff carry on was to attract their attention and perhaps get them to listen to something that they hadn't before. Bob, he had sold quantities of records, and but he wasn't huge. It wasn't as big as I thought he should be. And we really got the campaign well together. We have spent quite a lot of time on it, and I felt we had, conquered it. Legend, very easy to come up with legend. Whenever you said to people Bob Marley, they said he's a legend, and so it wasn't a big jump at that point. But the sound, the running order took quite a bit of effort. My son, who was at that time in utero, so to speak, he hadn't been born, but he was soon come, in the Jamaican patois, soon come. I used to take my wife. We were in vinyl in those days, so we're 20 minutes aside. I would take my wife at lunchtime on a drive out the motorway for 20 minutes and then back to listen to side two. And I'd make cassettes and we'd play them. Eventually, my son nearly kicked my wife out of the car, and I thought, God, we may have it. We may finally have it. My son is now a promoter of bass music festivals, around Europe, England. So he's continued in that vein, and remarkable. So the soundtrack really was compiled. It's track running compiled by Jack Robinson, very fast little boy.
Well, it sounds like he definitely absorbed music through his genetics, and I think that's terrific. Now, I want to talk about, of course, your pet project right now, which is Hardwick Circus. You kind of came out of semi-retirement to manage them. What drew you to this particular band, and what do you see as their potential in today's music landscape?
My son discovered them. Another son, I have three of them. So my youngest son, Milo, discovered them. He's a photographer, lives in Camden Town, which is a very has been for quite a number of years a very musical part of the London's underground, so to speak. And he heard music coming from a public house that he knew did not have music as part of their ongoing business. So he looked in, he saw a group playing in the middle of the floor, audience, very small and not particularly interested. But the band looked good, and he really liked it. He had always fancied his chances of becoming a manager. He wanted to follow, perhaps some of my, fatherly, carry on. So he called me. They'd come down from Carlisle, which is a very northern. It's about as north as you can go in England, before the Scottish border. So you're right on the border, Carlisle in Cumbria. And they'd come down and just chatted to the landlord and convinced the landlord to let them play, which was, well done and amazing at the same time. So they had one more show the following night, and he convinced me to go. And I really quite liked them. I thought, this is like somewhat like some of the bands of Stiff of yore. And I chatted to their father, and he was very taken with the idea of a father and son managing or looking after his offspring, two of whom were in the band, the drummer Thomas Foster and the lead singer Johnny Foster, very quite young. So I'd said I'd do it. I would make an effort. I would support my son on the basis that I advised and he would do the work. So I would come up with some plans. So a year later, when we started, getting somewhere, get the band playing, writing some decent songs, he then got a photographic job. He was a photographer, which, he left me in it because he said, well, look, Dad, you have to give me advice. Not that he ever called me Dad before, but Dave, he said, what do you think I should do? Knowing the answer that, he got a very good offer for a very good photographic job. And I said, well, you have to think of taking it. And then I realized that I was the pigeon. I was the one who would have to do the work. So that's why. And the business now is entirely different because there is no music in the record industry. It's the streaming obviously has changed things dramatically. It's particularly hard for a young band to get on, to get anywhere. The way in which we were able to torment the majors and get unusual records into the charts, both here and in America, have disappeared overnight. Streaming has changed that game. So they're having to do it the hard way. For example, we're on our way tomorrow to South Africa for a tour, a kind of 12 days in South Africa. So it shows you how far afield I will now convince the band to go to try and get their foot on the ladder. They are now writing incredibly good songs, probably the best they've had, and I think as good as anything I've had on Stiff before. So we're working on seeing if we can get that door opener, that big song, that big moment, and we're touring the world to try and do it. So yes, I'm still excited. I'm still into it. Obviously, I'm getting to the wrong end of the mountain. I'm going down it at the moment, but I think we'll get somewhere before the game ends.
Speaking of the game, it certainly changed a lot, as you said, with streaming, and I guess the only real way for a band to make money and garner fans is really to get out there and tour. I had read a interview with Peter Frampton several months ago where he said something like Spotify had 1 billion streams of one of his songs, and his check was $1,700. So things have changed a lot. How do you roll with those punches?
Well, you have to believe that what you're doing is useful. It's something that you have a passion for. If you didn't, you wouldn't do it, really. If your son now came to you and said, "I'm going to go in the music business," you would say, "No way, over my dead body," etc. The major record companies are a problem because the money, there is quite a bit of money, involved in all that streaming. But it goes to the record companies, and I don't think they're really killing themselves to find out who actually owns the copyrights that they're collecting money from. Because, if you have an ancestor who had a very, very good catalog, a few years ago, a major record company doesn't kill itself to find out who you are unless you take the case to them, get legal help, pay for this and that and whatever. They don't want to be reminded that maybe you're a grandchild of Chuck Berry or something. They're not, Elton is getting paid and obviously other people. But when you say live, I mean, live keeps you going, but you only gets you from one event to the next event. There is no big income now except in songwriting. If you can write and people see your music as something for their marketing plans or for their movies or something else, that's a good area. So publishing is good, but the record business, unfortunately, I fought the law and the law won. It was Smith fought the majors and kept them at bay for quite a long time and made them eat their words and put out four color single bags and all the things that that we caused to happen and people still remember. But nobody, there's very little independence in these days, and streaming, as poor Peter Frampton, who his live double album was the one that kind of launched an awful lot of people into it. He's now receiving a very tiny check for an awful lot of people hearing his music. It's a problem, a big problem, but you fight the good fight and you go out there and believe on a good night when the crowd are really with you, you believe that you can change the world. And that's what music has had over the past, rock and roll, in the title of your blog. That's what it's been. So it's continuing harder and harder, but we're still here and we're still trying to knock down the walls. Selling the catalog is another very strange thing. The ethos of the music was that you kind of held on to it, passed it on perhaps to your offspring, but you never got rid of it. That was the shining badge of your life. And so this idea that, oh well, I'll just sell it for zillions to some faceless guy who I've never seen so much Bob Dylan tracks in very odd places. It never used to be. There was always a lot of control over its use. It's hard to imagine the credibility that bands had and suffered for is now just kind of thrown by the wayside. But what can you say? It's a very changeable world. The ventures, well, that was great that your dad was involved in that. And the Shadows in England, Cliff Richard's the backing band, took all their moves and all their sounds from that band. So they had a great effect. But I don't know, it's a short memory. The record
True.
business has a very short memory, yes.
And to your point, I do remember I'm a big Led Zeppelin fan, and I remember how very protective they were of their songs being used in movies, and you would never very seldom hear their songs in movies. But you're right, like if they sold that to some faceless corporation, you'd hear Led Zeppelin on every TV commercial, every movie. There's not as much artistic integrity, I think. But like you said, it is also an ever-changing, evolving business, and it is a business.
Well, it was an art. There is a degree of art, this is art, and it just doesn't seem to. There aren't a lot of art lovers in the music business, so it would seem, and also the audience think that an awful lot of movement by the record companies is actually dictated by the artists, which is completely wrong. And so, communication and education would be great. But like a lot of political situations, the control is in the hands of the few who have the very big stakes, and they're not about to educate the general public about a great deal of the uses of the music. I still, I suppose I resent it a bit. It sounds like I have a chip on my shoulder, and that's probably true. But Hardwick Circus, for example, are flying that flag with my help, and so I have a real reason. I'm going to South Africa. I haven't been there since 1969, and I'm going to see what's what. So there's a lot of interest, funny enough, of an unknown UK band going to South Africa, supporting a lot of the local good groups there, has had a lot of interest. So we're going to have a good time, and I'm going to enjoy it. But there should be more. There should be more help, perhaps from the media end of things. The media are inclined to just swallow the major record companies' kind of slogans and propaganda, and it would need another stiff or something independent with a bit of an attitude. If that should turn up, we'd all join in.
Well, for those who are as yet uninitiated, how would you describe Hardwick Circus's sound and who are some of their influences in their music?
Well, Carlisle, as I said, is at the far reaches of the UK. So their music has kind of been in a bubble, so to speak. They haven't been interested in the digital revolution and computer music. They haven't really been interested in that. So they're dealing with the Doors. They're dealing with Bruce Springsteen. They are obviously genuine fans of Bob Dylan. The band is a great influence. In terms of the UK, they are influenced by some stiff artists, and they were like that before I met them. I've obviously perhaps told them the same story a few times, as you do in terms of keeping the band entertained on the road. But that kind of music, that kind of period, to my mind, 70s, early 80s, 60s, 70s, early 80s was the creme de la creme. There was stuff there that you hear the music now and it resonates just as strongly as it did at that time. And they're influenced by that period. They have some different stuff, but it's songwriting that makes it happen. And that's what you try and encourage groups to do. You say, if you write, then it's got to, and you sing, so you've got a way of presenting it. And that's I've signed songwriters. I mean, Bob Marley was a great songwriter, and I signed all the people who could write. They weren't all oil paintings on the day, but they also made funny videos, and we had a lot of fun. MTV came at a crucial time to Stiff, and we had a lot of fun. There's a DJ in the UK called John Peel, who is legendary at the BBC. He did his own thing and ignored the corporate encouragement, and he liked a lot of Stiff. So we got a lot of plug. If you look back and wonder why, and can you duplicate it, it's difficult because those people don't exist anymore. There's not a lot of triers. There are not a lot of people who push the envelope much. Everyone likes to kind of, do the same
Everybody wants to
thing.
be liked. Yes.
Yeah, probably the answer. The good title for a song.
There you go. You can have it. Well, I want to talk about some of the positives of the music industry today. What are some of the advantages or some of the maybe the coolest things that a band and a manager can do today to leverage, say, social media? Or what are some of the things that you've found that are really great for a band starting out now?
Well, it comes down to a lot of the same things, really. I mean, nowadays the people don't turn up on television. Television was a great marketer of your band, and your band presenting their music on TV was great. We don't have that now. Certainly not in the UK. We don't have the festivals became everybody's idea of what's happening, but it is hardly a headliner under 70 now. I mean, nobody has brought up the younger bands to show. There are a few, there's a few here and there, but A movement, it doesn't seem so. It doesn't seem that, for example, chart was to a great extent the judgment of whether you were happening or not. It's not so much nowadays, but it to me, being an old campaigner, it seems an awful lot like a cabaret show. Everybody's got a great dance. Everyone's kind of really kind of wild and wacky and whatever. But the songs don't appear to resonate as much as we were used to. Led Zeppelin, a good example. The Ventures instrumental, I would like to go back to that because I did enjoy. They were my early years, so they were part of the sound of my particular beginning. It's got to be exciting. It's got to be artistic. It's got to be about something. It's got to be folk music to a degree. The Beatles were Liverpool folk music, and Hardwick Circus are Carlisle folk music, if we see it in that kind of light. Except Carlisle is a 70,000 town, so they call themselves a city, but it's really a very big town, and. I did the Pogues was a very good example where they were kind of an English version of an Irish folk music. So I see most of the music as folk. I don't mean this stuff where people have beards and go shush all the time. You know, I'm not talking about with one finger in their ear so they can pitch to the note. I like social music that sings to us or tells us about the story of the lives of the individuals that are taking a part in a specific area. You know, Nashville, you know, phenomenal, but LA and New York, inevitable because people headed there to try and get going. But lots of areas in New Orleans, I mean, there's music that still resonates out of that town, even though they've had some terrible weather and physical problems down there. And I like that. I went to Akron, Ohio to sign Devo, and I think it was I left New York. It was sunshine. I had a t-shirt and a pair of shorts on. I got to Akron. It's the biggest blizzard that the area had had in whatever, and we got snowed into a motel. But bands kept banging on the door. They heard that somebody was there who might be interested in their music. And we did put out the, you know, an Akron album, which had the scratch and sniff cover, so you could got the smell of burnt rubber whenever. I had a warehouse full of that smell actually for quite a while. So finding a way to attract the public's attention to care about or to own. How about owning the music? That was what we all started out to do, owning the music. We did research to find out who had played on what, who had written what, we unfortunately have dropped down in that ladder. However, you never can tell. Reckless Eric is a very good example of a stiff artist who struggled for quite a few years, and he had a few substance problems, and he excused the dinging that you hear from time to time. I should make an effort to stop it. It's my phone telling me that somebody else is is happening.
Okay.
Reckless Eric, he went on lots of stiff tours. He worked very hard. Expedia, which is a travel agency, decided eventually that they needed a song to market their site, and the whole wide world, a song by Reckless Eric, finally a great song, finally saw the light of day, and he did very well. He was financially, he got a boost, and his career got a boost. So he is now, you know, his career has taken off a lot more than it did when he first signed to Stiff and when he wrote the song. That's really good. Nick Lowe, you have Nick Lowe was the bass player in a band I looked after called Brinsley Schwartz. And his song, What's So Funny About Peace, Love and Understanding, which has been recorded by quite an awful lot of people, including Bruce and Elvis Costello and lots of people. When it became a track on the Bodyguard soundtrack, which is the biggest movie soundtrack album I think ever, that was very helpful and reformed his life to a degree. That gave him the clue that he should pick himself up and do something proper with his life. And he's now touring the world, having a great time. Not in big places, though, in kind of supper clubs and coffee houses and wine warehouses, where he plays to, 1,000 people, 600 to 1,000. And his career is going as strong as ever. So it's good to see that the Stiffs that are above ground, so to speak, are still banging in the miles. Stiff was a very live, I was very keen on live music, encouraged everybody to go out and do it, and they're still doing it. So it's when you go to one of those shows, it's very encouraging. It's very good. It's a great evening, and more people should look at the grassroots bands and maybe support them a bit more. That would be very, very useful. So I'm hopeful. I don't want to be depressing about it, but they say if you want to borrow money, always always borrow it from a what's the word? Somebody who's pessimistic, because he won't think he's going to get it back. So anyway,
Well, as an audience member, I certainly appreciate the smaller venues and the more intimate feel of being able to
You're in LA.
experience the
You're
music.
in LA?
No, I'm in Las Vegas. In fact, the
Okay.
Sphere is just outside my window here, and the Eagles, speaking of over 70 artists, are have a residency here at the Sphere, and tickets are thousands of dollars. So, I mean, that really lets out a lot of music fans that can't afford it.
I saw them in Manchester about 2 months ago, and the Doobie Brothers were the support act. So a great evening. John McPhee, who's in the Doobie Brothers, he's a guitar player in the Doobie Brothers 25 years now. He is the guitar player on Elvis Costello's My Aim Is True.
Oh, wow.
And the connection was that he was in a band called Clover from Marin County. And he came over to England and I signed them up. Huey Lewis was the harmonica player. And John, when he came here, thought, which I thought was marvelous, he thought to invite me up for an evening with the Eagles and the Doobie Brothers. Very, quite extraordinary. Two very different bands, but with great vocals. And I was particularly, I mean, I was so impressed. It was so good. I'm hoping to do it again. I want to go over and see John back in California.
What is your own personal rock and roll nightmare?
Well, it could be tomorrow. It could be lack of flights and all those kind of things. I mean, being touring in the early well, the back end of the 60s, probably. There was no criteria for how it all worked. There was no, obviously, the ventures were before us, but it was always a question of could we get to the next show, because the schedules by the agents were always completely unrealistic. They'd never been or looked at a map or seen those miles. And it was around the time that I think there was a maybe Carter was the president. Jimmy Carter is still with us, God bless him. And he brought in the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit to try and conserve oil. If that looking for a rock and roll nightmare, that was a regular one every couple of days, where we couldn't quite move to the next place. I don't, otherwise, I like it. I don't have, it's hard to imagine a nightmare. Those days were fantastic because nobody knew what it was you did. You were inventing it as you moved along. But
Mitch Mitchell, who was the drummer with Jimi Hendrix, on one occasion, he got in very late from a late night club after the show, and he put all the furniture behind the door of his room. He moved all the furniture so that me, the tour manager, who had a flight at 8 o'clock and had to get people out of the hotel by 7, was trying to get in, was trying to appeal to Mitch, and he wasn't having any. And he didn't answer, whatever. So I got the manager of the hotel with me, and I showed him my briefcase. I opened it so I could see the vast amount of money I had collected over the previous week. And I said, "I'm going to knock the door down, but I will pay for it immediately. If you could get a carpenter here to estimate while I'm doing it." He said, "You can't do that. You can't do that." So I had a fire axe in my hand and I hacked the door down. Mitch told me I would be fired and called me some very rude anti-Irish names.
Oh,
And so I said, "Fine, Mitch, you don't want to go? I'll leave you. Here's some money. I'll leave it with the manager. And maybe you would think about getting to the next show, but I can't do everything for you. I can't make up your mind if you whatever." So he turned up. He got to the show, I think, a quarter of an hour before showtime. Oh, I'd already lined up another drummer. One of the other band's drummer was going to knew, well, we couldn't play as well as Mitch, but knew the songs. Jimmy had agreed. And Mitch arrived saying he would have me fired by 9 o'clock the following morning. And of course, that didn't happen. But everybody from then on, remarkably, was on time. It was really quite a good move.
In closing, where can folks find Hardwick Circus? Do they have a website or they have social media tour schedules online?
Just Hardwick Circus, one word, dot TV, as in television. You do that, and you'll get. And their website has got everything on it that you, I would hope, that you will like. So it's good. They're good. And thank you very much, Stacey, for having us.
Oh, thanks, Dave. I appreciate it. Safe travels tomorrow.
Thanks a lot.
This concludes another episode of the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. Remember, there's a book series too. All the books are available in paperback, ebook, and audio via Amazon or the Rock and Roll Nightmares website. That's ROCK-N-ROLL-nightmares.com. Our official theme song is She's Out for Blood by Fuzzbuster, founded by Lars Cabot. Thank you for listening.